and welcome to episode 2 of the Z-Realm. I'm Marty of the Flickers from the Cave podcast, and I am joined by KMO, who is known as the host of the Z-Realm podcast, as well as the host of the, the ETC Voices podcast?
Well, that one's been on hiatus for a couple of months, but yes, I plan to get back to it pretty soon here.
Okay. So we are talking about zombies and all their glory. In the last episode, which was the first episode, we talked a little bit about the whole ideas of zombies. And in this one, we want to focus a little more on the comic book about which the upcoming AMC Walking Dead TV series is based. KMO, had you heard of this before you heard of the TV series?
I had, yes. Actually, somebody had recommended it to me on the C-Realm discussion group over at thegrowreport.com. And I had intended to check it out, and I just never did until the announcement of this series by Frank Darabont. And we mentioned Frank Darabont last week on the podcast, or in the first episode. So we should also mention Robert Kirkman. He is the author of the Walking Dead comic book, and he is intimately involved in the creation of the TV series as well.
Yes, and it seems like he's writing it, he's consulting on it, he's doing a lot of things. So I'm really have high hopes that it stays true to the source material.
And I have watched pretty much anything I could get my hands on online. Which for me requires a commitment because I have to get up in the middle of the night to actually get the bandwidth to watch streaming video. And I've heard Robert Kirkman say that this AMC TV series is The Walking Dead. It's not The Walking Dead light, you know. It's not some approximation of The Walking Dead. It is his vision. So I'm very excited about that.
I had heard of the comic book quite a bit through various video gaming podcasts that I listened to. Where that sort of crowd, the video game crowd, the plugged in, you know, generation whatever crowd, obviously they're still reading comic books, still playing video games, and doing all that. And they had went on and on about the Walking Dead books, and I was very interested, but I didn't actually take the time to search them out until I heard about the TV series.
When I was driving through, I was going to Kay's house, and I was running early, so I stopped at a Barnes & Noble, I think, in Greensboro, and I picked up the compendium or the compilation. It was this huge thing. It cost $60, and I started flipping through it, and I thought, oh, wow, this is great. I really should get this, but the price tag threw me off. I couldn't quite justify the expenditure, although now that I'm buying the $10 trade paperbacks, I figure I would have been better off just spending that $60 up front. But at the time, it just seemed a little too precious in the store, a little too pricey. But I wish I had got it.
Well, Kay had bought the, volume 2 of the bound version because the volume 1 was sold out and she just wanted to read it. Well, she started reading it, and then when she finished with it, I picked it up and read maybe the first comic out of there, which was not even, 15 pages, whatever. And I immediately ran out and bought that compendium because it was clearly the best value, and it is heavy. So, you might have, your wrist probably is going to thank you for not having that big heavy thing, you know, weighting it in. it's massive, but it is really good. And I when I started it, I read the first chapter, which is 10 comics, I guess, all bundled together in the first go, and then have gone back and have sort of more deliberately read the second chapter, and it's so far it is keeping the quality high.
Well, yeah, I've got the first volume. The one that Frank Darabont purchased in a comic book store, and after he read it, he called his agent to see if they could get the rights to it. And I've put that into the hands of other people here at the Eco Village Training Center, and most everybody reads it from cover to cover in one sitting. People can't put it down. People who have no previous interest in zombie material.
Well, it is really well written, and I think the first volume is just amazingly well drawn, too. I think the art does take a little bit of a dive in the second one, but it's still good, and the writing is just as strong as it is in the first.
And the art actually comes back
after
that second volume. The second volume is really heavy on blacks, and there's a lot of close-ups, and a lot of the detail in the characters' faces is lost. And in later volumes, something more closely resembling what you see in that first volume comes back. And I'm very happy to report that. But yeah, even so, with just the writing on its own, if my fourth grade son were drawing it and Robert Kirkman were writing it, I would still read it.
I think you might be a little more knowledgeable about comics in general than I am. Do you know of anything else what Robert Kirkman had done before?
He did a comic called Battle Pope.
Oh, okay. I've heard of that.
Yeah, but The Walking Dead is definitely, it was a stretch for him, and he has certainly risen to the challenge.
It's good drama. There's real character development. There's real characters in it, especially the main character and his family. They're really well drawn. And I don't mean drawn with ink. I mean drawn with words. There is a lot of depth to those characters.
And one thing we should mention, since we are going to be talking about the comic book, we had discussed previously, there will be spoilers. So it really looks like, at least for the pilot, the AMC series is going to stick very close to the comic book. So if you haven't seen the pilot episode yet, and you haven't read the comic, then, fair warning, spoiler alert, spoilers coming. So you might want to stop the podcast now and maybe pick it up after you've seen the first episode. Although my suspicion is most of the people listening will have already seen the first episode of the TV show before they ever hear this podcast.
And for sure they might have read the comic book by now.
And if they haven't, again, you have been warned. So something that everybody comments on when they just open the first page of the comic is that it's very similar to the opening of 28 Days Later. The main character wakes up in a hospital. He has been in a coma. The hospital seems deserted. And he ends up wandering around, an abandoned, seemingly abandoned city, only to encounter, in 28 Days Later, the infected, or here, the Walking Dead. And I had a discussion in 2007 with novelist Brian Trent about that. Not about The Walking Dead, but about 28 Days Later and about zombie films. And he mentioned many ways in which 28 Days Later was very similar to the novel The Day of the Triffids. It seems to begin in very much the same way.
The Day of the Triffids. When terror reigned from the sky. Day of the Triffids, when the Earth orbits into a nightmare. When the solid world of everyday reality disintegrates. And the whole population is driven by fear towards insanity. The Day of the Triffids, when destruction closes in from every side.
Pilot, is he blind too?
To be starvation, fire, pestilence. Anyone caught in the middle of it doesn't stand a chance. I think we ought to get out of here and go on to Spain.
How can you know it's any better there?
I don't.
The Day of the Triffids, when law and order are overwhelmed in an avalanche of terror.
I went on Wikipedia and I looked to check on the release dates for both 28 Days Later and The Walking Dead comic. 28 Days Later came out in 2002, and The Walking Dead comic premiered in 2003, and Wikipedia didn't give months. So my guess is that the comic book, while it came out a little later, the writing process was probably well underway by the time 28 Days Later came out. So I think that's probably a coincidence, or both the author of 28 Days Later and Robert Kirkman were tuned in to some previous source material or had Day of the Triffids in the back of their head. I don't think that The Walking Dead just nakedly ripped off 28 Days Later.
to me, well, 28 days later starts with the character waking up in the hospital, but The Walking Dead, at least the version I read, it started with the incident that puts the character into the hospital with the car.
Oh, that's right.
There's
the
car,
he gets shot.
And he gets shot, and then he wakes up in the hospital. So it is slightly different. To me, 28 weeks later is much more akin to like a video game story or something, where you're a character with amnesia, and then you learn about yourself through the course of the video game. In this case, it was a movie. but 28 days later is an amazing zombie movie. But I don't know. I think that's a little more kitschy, where the Walking Dead is much more kind of, here's a character, here's a story. And, you know, he doesn't know what happened while he was in the coma, but he finds out later. But it's amazing, that moment when he wakes up in the hospital and it's deserted, or is it? That's going to be scary stuff to see that moving around.
Yes, yes. Although, with both 28 Days Later and The Walking Dead, I had to sort of push down a little incredulity that asserted itself. It's like, how long has he been lying in this bed, alive but untended, you know, unfed? He doesn't seem to have a catheter or a bedpan. He's just, you know, lying there like Sleeping Beauty, and then he opens his eyes. And it seems like the zombie apocalypse has unfolded at least many days ago, if not a couple weeks back. So how long has he been there? I don't know. It seems like he couldn't have been there too long, otherwise he wouldn't be in any shape to get up and walk around and run and, you know, push zombies off of him and fall down the stairs while tussling with a zombie. But that was really the only moment of, you know, incredulity in the whole first volume of the comics for me.
I guess that's one of those suspension of disbelief things. And being that it was a comic book instead of a film, I didn't even pause to think about that. I just went with it. Perhaps on the TV series where, you know, you're seeing it moving around in color and sound, maybe they'll change something a little bit to make it more believable.
So he wakes up. He discovers, actually, while he's still in the hospital, that there are zombies. He disregards a note on a door that says, "Don't open this door, dead people behind it." And he opens it, and there are zombies, and they start coming out, and he falls down the stairs while tussling with one, and it breaks its neck, and he takes off his belt, and he uses his belt to secure one of the doors in the stairwell so that he can give himself time to get out of the hospital. And then he wanders out into the world, and he discovers that it's a wreck and that there's nobody around until I think he goes to his home, and he gets hit on the head by the son of a man who has taken up residence in either his house or the house next door.
Yeah, I think it's the neighbor's house.
Do you want to comment on anything up to that point, or do you want to just continue with the narrative?
One of the things that really got me, where did the thing happen with the body on the side of the road, the, like, bicycle wreck?
That happens twice. He encounters that zombie twice.
Right, but does that happen on his initial jaunt from the hospital is when he encounters it the first time, right?
I think so, yes.
Okay, well, that was powerful stuff, and I think they're clearly doing that in the series, because I think they've shown that, the kind of half-zombie in the clips that's crawling, I think has got to be that moment.
I think so.
So Rick Grimes, who is he's a sheriff's deputy, right? I think that's
He's
right.
Some sort of police officer.
He's a lawman. So he is involved in a shooting at the beginning of the comic book, wakes up in the hospital, and goes, when he leaves the hospital, the world has gone south. Everything is in disarray, and as I recall, and it's been several weeks since I read that, he doesn't really encounter zombies after he leaves the hospital until later. But he does encounter...
Well, as you mentioned, he stumbles across the one from whom he takes the bicycle.
Right.
And in the comic book, she's lying on her back, and she was wearing biking gear, which was pretty tight-fitting, and it's been pulled up, and you can see, like, one breast sort of hanging off to the side, and the other side is just completely eaten away. And I notice in the TV series, she's face down, so, you know, the bare breast issue doesn't come out. But he sees her, he's horrified, but he gets on what is obviously her bicycle and rides away. He rides to his home, where he gets hit on the head and knocked out by the son of the man who has moved in. And then once he comes to, then that character, the man with the son, he explains what's happened. And we as the audience get a bit of explanation as to what's going on. Although you and I as zombie aficionados, we know the basic structure of the zombie apocalypse. We don't really need any explanation. But the character gets some explanation.
In the comic, it's not one of these moments where they have to convince you of it either. I mean, he has seen these things. He knows there's something going on. It's hard for him to get his head wrapped around it, but it's not like he's struggling and saying, no, it can't be.
So Rick wakes up after being knocked out, and he meets Morgan and his son Dwayne. And Morgan explains to Rick what has occurred. And then Rick takes all three of them to the sheriff's office. And he goes into the armory and he stocks up on weapons and ammunition. And he gives Morgan permission to take, to arm himself from the sheriff's armory. And at this point, Rick is talking about, okay, you're going to need this. Look after my house and my neighbor's house. I recognize that I'm sort of bending the rules here by letting you take some of this, but I think under the circumstances it's warranted. But Rick's assumption at this point is that things will be getting back to normal, that the government is going to come in, is going to evacuate people who need evacuation, is going to take care of the zombies, either cure them or dispose of them, and things will be getting back to normal here pretty soon. And that is a theme that runs throughout not only that first volume, but ongoing in the comic. At some point, just about every character realizes things are not going back to normal, ever. But it takes some of them longer than others to come to that realization. And so later, when we get to Atlanta and Rick is reunited with his family, his partner and best friend Shane is there. And Shane is a holdout in terms of thinking that things will be going back to normal and that what they're doing is not finding the way by which they're going to be surviving long term, but just holding out long enough for the government to come and rescue them, which is why Shane wants to stay near Atlanta rather than moving out into the countryside away from that mass of zombies. I wonder if you've got any comment you'd like to add to this notion that things will be coming back to normal, that this is a delusion, and that some people are hampered by it more than others.
Well, one thing you mentioned earlier in the description of the storyline that I'd like to go back to just briefly is the fact that Rick Grimes, the main character, when he does meet Dwayne and Morgan, he says it a couple of times there, and then he says it later. These are the rules normally, but this is not a normal situation, and I don't think we need to stick to those rules. He gives Morgan and Dwayne a police car because he says you're going to need that. That'll work a lot better than what you're using now. And he wants to do what's right, maybe not what's in the rule book, but he wants to do what he knows is right. So they paint him very early in the storyline as a guy who is concerned about the right thing to do and not so much about what the rules say. And I thought that was a really great and appealing character trait for him to have. And the reason that he leaves there to go to Atlanta is his wife has family there, and the word that went out from the civil defense was to go towards a major population center, and then you'll be rescued from there. So Atlanta is where he thinks they would have gone since they have relatives there. So that's where he decides to head to. So that's sort of his motivation for going that place. It wasn't just that he picked Atlanta out of a hat. When you do get to the area where he's reunited with his wife and young son, there are people there who are desperately waiting for the government or the army to come rolling in and to save them. I think at the beginning they're all sort of that mindset, but as time drags on, Rick begins to think that maybe that's not going to happen, and it's tough for him to convince the others that's the case. And so he's got his firm beliefs about the status of the world and about things not changing, and everybody else is holding on to this belief that at any moment they're going to hear the helicopters or they're going to hear the tanks coming up the road that are going to save them and take them and return them to their normal life.
What's interesting is that the comic book premiered in 2003, before Hurricane Katrina. So there is no mention of FEMA in the comic book. And since the beginning of the comic book, and with the monumental failure of FEMA in the response to Hurricane Katrina, that name, or that acronym, F-E-M-A, is now very much, it's very present in the public consciousness. And I'm wondering if they're going to actually mention FEMA by name in this series, rather than just making vague allusions to the government.
I feel like they almost have to update it, and that would include putting FEMA in there, or Homeland Security, or whatever. You know, I think that would be a concern now. I mean, if something like this were to actually happen now, you would have people who were sure it was some sort of Al-Qaeda plot, and there would be people who would be concerned, you know, would be completely positive that it's some sort of conspiracy to, you know, get us all out of here, some sort of, what is it, the Georgia Guidestones with the, you know, reduced population thing, that it's some sort of deliberate move to get rid of, you know, some of the population of the earth.
And who knows? I mean, we don't know what causes the zombie apocalypse, at least having read the first four volumes now of the Living Dead, none of the characters know. So it will be interesting to see if in the very long term, if that is ever revealed. Maybe it has been in the comic. I don't know.
Romero never really explains. I mean, they might say, you know, I think in the first one they say it was a satellite that came back to Earth and maybe it brought a virus with it. You know, in 28 weeks later and 28 days later, it's the rage virus. So there's different things. But, you know, the idea that it was deliberately done, or that it could have been deliberately done, that would make for some interesting storylines. So to get back to the storyline in the comic book, Rick eventually does make his way to Atlanta, to the middle of Atlanta, and it is a war zone. It is something from I Am Legend or any other sort of apocalyptic film. And the city is in ruins. There's cars abandoned everywhere. There's dead bodies everywhere. There is no sign of the military or of the law enforcement. No, you know, camps set up to, you know, for the survivors. And he wanders through this destroyed town, he encounters massive amounts of zombies. And it's interesting, and I'm wondering how they're going to handle it. In the comic book, he gets to Atlanta on horseback.
He does in the television show as well. I've seen in the previews him riding the horse, and also I've seen still images of the scene where he gets knocked off the horse and most of the zombies go for the horse, which allows him to get away.
Right, and that's going to be, man, I don't know how much I'm looking forward to seeing that, because that is heavy in the comic.
You know, one thing it's interesting, Max Brooks, the author of World War Z, says that he has read and enjoyed The Walking Dead. But Robert Kirkman said that he will not let himself read World War Z until after he is finished with The Walking Dead. And since The Walking Dead is ongoing, it's basically, you know, that amounts to he'll never read it.
Wow.
And I noticed that one thing that is similar in the two zombie narratives is that these zombies are ravenous for any living flesh. In World War Z, the zombies eat everything, all animals, you know, they'll walk across a field full of cows and just eat all the cows. And in The Walking Dead, the same is true. The zombies will eat horses, obviously, or other farm animals. They're just hungry for flesh. Whereas in George Romero's films, the zombies, they ignore animals. They are only interested in humans. And in Island of the Dead, it's a major milestone when one of the zombie characters actually takes a bite out of a horse rather than a human being. So that's one place where Kirkman has diverged from Romero, and where Kirkman and Brooks have picked up on the same thing and gone the same direction.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting change. And, I think it makes sense for them to eat the anything, because obviously they're going to be starving just like, you know, we would be without food. So, and it's interesting, as you mentioned that in the movies, because I can remember in the Zack Snyder remake of Dawn of the Dead, there's actually this scene where they send the dog out into the zombie horde, and it just walks through them without any trouble.
Right. That's what I was thinking of as well when I mentioned that they ignored animals. And in Day of the Dead, in the very beginning, when the helicopter lands and the people are using the bullhorn to say, you know, survivors come out, and all these zombies come pouring out, and some zombies shuffle past an alligator. and they ignore the alligator, and the alligator sort of hisses at them, but doesn't really do anything. He knows from long experience that these are not things to be eaten. Although one thing that really bothers me is that it's obvious that the alligator's snout is strapped closed so that he cannot bite any of these zombie actors. You know, if that were done today, they could use CGI to get rid of that strap. But as it stands, it's very obvious.
I didn't even notice that.
Well, I've probably spoiled it for you now. Next time you see Day of the Dead, that will just leap out at you.
Yes, it will. That's generally the case. So when Rick Grimes gets to Atlanta, he encounters the next character that you that is central to the storyline, which is this character of Glenn, who is a young Asian man who is running through Atlanta gathering supplies. And when he finds Rick, he says, "Come, follow me," and they run. They get out of Atlanta.
And this illustrates something that is obviously of central importance to me in the whole zombie mythos. And Rick is surrounded by zombies. He's been shooting them. Anytime he encounters anything that looks vaguely human, it's a threat to him, and he either has to run or shoot it. And Glenn comes up right behind him and takes a hold of him, and Rick turns and points the gun at him ready to shoot, but in an instant he recognizes that here is another human being, and he doesn't shoot. And that is something that, I talked about in my conversation with Tom Barbalay that we played in the first episode, and it's something I've mentioned in conversations with Neil Kramer and others about zombies, is that the zombie apocalypse turns almost all humans into a threat to you, but those few humans who are left, who at a glance look superficially different at best from zombies, you can tell immediately that these are the people on your team. And even if you have some underlying prior disagreement with them, some ideological friction or some in-group, out-group sort of antagonism, you can recognize in an instant that this is a living person. The zombies are a threat to them just like they're a threat to you, and that you two are automatically on the same side. And when Rick meets Glenn for the first time, that happens in one panel, which is just an instant.
And that's one of the things that the zombie films and other zombie media really points out, is that even during the zombie apocalypse, you've still got to worry about the other survivors, because everybody's in the same boat. We're all struggling over resources and supplies, and the other living human beings are just as big a threat, if not more, than the undead zombies.
What's interesting there, I think, is that when two individual survivors encounter each other, generally they band together automatically. But when two groups of survivors encounter each other, then there's a competition between the groups, or there's more likely to be a competition. Which sort of goes, harkens back to our tribal cognitive wiring.
Have you read The Road or seen the movie?
I have seen the movie. I regret I have not yet read the novel.
Well, I know in that it's a similar situation. It's an apocalyptic tale, and it's about the dangers of survivors. I mean, the scariest things he encounters in that in the book were the roving bands of survivors. He would have been a lot happier had he and his son be the only survivors left.
Yeah, that would have been a much easier existence.
And in The Walking Dead, as far as I've gotten into it, there are groups that are maybe a little unsettled, but he hasn't encountered just roving bands of survivors who are out just pillaging. And I'm sure that'll happen. I'm not, don't spoil it for me. But, I haven't seen it yet, but it's got to come up.
One thing that makes The Road every bit as fantastical and improbable or unbelievable as a zombie apocalypse is that the only things left alive are human beings. And there are no animals of any kind except for one dog. There are no insects. I mean, we've got all this rotting wood from trees. Trees are falling down dead, but there are no insects eating them. There is no mushrooms eating all the dead wood. No mycorrhizal fungi getting into the wood and eating it up. There's nothing to eat except the remnants of human society, whatever canned goods can be found, and other humans. And even in that scenario, you have bands of people who have gathered together and they are looking for stragglers. They're looking for individuals not to join their group, but to be food. There's the roving band, and then there's also the people who live in the house who are, you know, keeping a basement full of their supposed, you know, presumably their neighbors or people who lived in the area that they have rounded up and forced into the basement and whom they're eating, you know, one person at a time. So even in The Road, which is, you know, it incorporates this utterly fantastical element in order to maximize just how gruesome the situation is for the main characters, even there you have people cooperating with one another. And it's generally groups cooperating and either preying on individuals or competing with other groups.
Yeah, there are those random individuals that they encounter, at least in the book, where, because I have not seen the movie, but in the book they'll encounter a one guy and they don't trust him, and the guy needs food, needs help, but the dad in the story is afraid to help him because of the fact that it would, you know, be less food for he and his son. And it's that sort of hard decision that you have to make. You know, are you going to help these people, or are you just going to look out for yourself? And in The Walking Dead, I think they do a good job of showing people banding together due to this common, you know, circumstance. It's even though they're surrounded by the undead, it's a slightly more hopeful scenario, I think, than what you're offered in The Road.
What's interesting about The Road, at least in the movie, and I think the movie stays pretty close to the book, because I know the encounter with the man that you're talking about, he's played by Robert Duvall in the film.
Oh, wow.
But the film opens with Viggo Mortensen looking out the window, presumably seeing the flash of a nuclear weapon or something, and immediately filling the bathtub with water, and we can see that his wife is pregnant. And then flash forward, you know, he and the wife are debating about whether they should all just kill themselves, and she ends up just walking out into the cold to die. And their son is, you know, 8, 9, 10, something like that. So a long time has passed between the apocalyptic event, whatever it was, and where the story picks up. A very long time, you know, enough time for the kid basically to be born and to pass the first decade of his life. And in The Walking Dead, you know, we haven't seen what's that far down the line yet. Things could be much better by then, or they could be utterly desperate the way that they are in The Road. So those are two very different scenarios, really. Perhaps in the beginning, just after the apocalyptic event that starts off The Road, maybe people were cooperating. You know, maybe their humanity was still a lot more intact, and it was just after a decade of hardscrabble existence and a drift toward, you know, human-on-human predatory lifestyle that somebody like the man in The Road finds it so hard to behave humanely, and it's his son, who's this angelic character who's always pleading with him, you know, Papa, please don't kill that man, or we'll never eat people, even if we're starving, right, Papa?
It's
so who knows, you know, The Walking Dead could get that bad.
Oh, absolutely it could. At least in The Walking Dead, it looks like there are other animals, there are the ability to grow food. So, I mean, the one farm that they encounter, I mean, they are growing food. So, you know, there is at least the chance that survival could continue.
Yes, whereas in The Road, there is just no such possibility. You know, one thing that's interesting, I don't recall offhand any zombie apocalypse movies or other media where these still living human beings resort to cannibalism just out of necessity. Can you think of any?
No, but that would be really, that would make it even more interesting to kind of do that comparison and that contrast to say, look, we're doing the same thing they're doing, you know.
But we know it. They don't even know it. They're just animals.
Right. We're doing it on purpose. Yeah. That would be interesting. I think you need to start writing that script.
Yes, I've been just trying to write down the stories that I was telling my children at bedtime, and that's very slow going.
Yeah, I think I remember you talking about that briefly on one of your podcasts.
Well, I described the general themes and tone of the story to Eric Davis. We were talking about H.P. Lovecraft in the Halloween special a year ago.
Okay.
And I was telling him about the sort of Lovecraftian themes that have worked their way into this this everything soup of a ongoing bedtime story that I was telling my children.
Yeah, I can remember it. It was the cats were a key component.
Yes, yes. Sadly, well, one of those two cats died recently.
It broke my heart. Yeah, because that was Boots. That's who I saw here at my house. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you met Boots. That's right.
Yeah. Very sad.
Well.
So let's see.
Back to zombies.
It's
so much easier for me to talk about the potential end of the world and the death of millions of hypothetical people than to think about the death of one real cat.
Well, you know that one real cat.
Yeah.
That makes a big difference. I mean, it makes a big difference to me. I mean, I care about the people in my little circle. And, I care about others too, but it's not going to make me cry as much as if something were to happen to someone I know.
And that's a theme that gets explored in a lot of not just zombie films, but apocalyptic films, where you've got people who had some prior connection to one another, and that connection takes precedence. You know, so in The Road, the father and the son. Did you see The Book of Eli?
I've got it, but I have not watched it.
Okay, well then I won't say anything about it. Well, we can maybe talk about it next time.
Okay.
Well, back to the comic book.
Yes.
Rick has hooked up with Glenn, and Glenn takes Rick to the encampment. And along the way, Glenn is giving Rick more information about what's happened, and Rick comes to the conclusion that his wife and son must be dead, and he breaks down and he cries along the way. And then they get to the camp, and his wife and son are there, along with his partner and best friend, Shane, and some other people.
Yes, it's a group that have already gathered, so he doesn't have to get there and start rounding up people to form a group. He gets there, the group is already founded, they already have relationships, they know each other, they've all been through God knows how many adventures already in terrible situations, and they've banded together against this sort of this horrible situation. And it's actually on that run from Atlanta out to the encampment where Glenn tells Rick that about what has happened in Atlanta and why they've left the city and the kind of situation that's developed, because Rick is really hoping that when he gets to Atlanta, he's going to find those camps, those refugee camps, and he's going to find the government, he's going to find the army, he's going to be able to, you know, survive. And it's when he sees all this stuff and how things have gone wrong, and he hears about how the city was abandoned, and that's when he gives up hope. And I think, to me, where you were talking about him waking up in the hospital and like not having bed sores and just getting up and running and being able to fight, how that was sort of I don't know. To me, the fact that he stumbles into this random group of people and his wife and son and former coworker are there, that was the bigger moment for me to kind of go, well, come on. But, you know, you have to kind of go with it. That's the impetus for the story. So, you know, I kind of roll with it. But that was a bit of a stretch, I thought.
Yes, yes. Although you had to have it that way for him in order for him to break down like that and give up hope and then go and be reunited with his wife. And, you know, that's a moment. It's a rare moment in the Walking Dead of, you know, people being really happy and a pleasant surprise. There are so few pleasant surprises and so many unpleasant surprises for the characters in The Walking Dead. You know, where we've described thus far, this seems to be the area of the story, at least as far as I can tell from the previews, where they have inserted new material for the television series. Because I've seen characters in the trailers that I don't recognize from the comic. And it seems to be taking place on rooftops and such in Atlanta. So it seems like when Rick gets to Atlanta, there's more drama there. Or perhaps it's still back in his hometown, but there are characters that I don't recognize from the comic. And they seem to be, well, Rick is telling these characters, look, the only thing I'm interested in is to find my wife and son. That's all I care about. So it seems that that's where the story in the TV series is going to be bulked up and will include new material that we haven't yet seen in the comic.
There's just so much they can add. I mean, they can add a whole cavalcade of red shirts to come on each week and, you know, fall prey. And, you know, it's such a brilliant idea because you've got an easy in and an easy out for any character. So you could have guest stars, you could have, you know, the, what, you know, star of the week, star of the month, star of the season. someone who's got some time that wants to come on and be a character, and they can find a survivor. That'll be the character. And then at the end of their run, they get eaten. And I just think it's a brilliant framework for a television drama.
You know, the X-Files used to be like that, in that in each season you would have a handful of episodes that advanced the larger story arc. And these were the episodes that were written by Chris Carter and David Duchovny. And then for the rest of the episodes in that season, you know, outside writers would be brought in, and they would create a little self-contained tale where at the end of the episode, in terms of the larger story arc, everything's right back to where it was. You know, it's very much a Scooby-Doo sort of thing where, you know, no long-term relationships have been changed. You know, no characters that you expect to be present in the ongoing story have been lost. No new characters have been added. It's just sort of a little side loop that is self-contained and that attaches to the larger story at a particular point along the way. And Frank Darabont has explicitly said that they're going to be doing not necessarily that exact thing, but that they are going to be sticking to the narrative, you know, the large, the big picture narrative laid out by Kirkman in the comic book series. But, you know, they will come back to that big narrative every now and again, but that they are going to take a lot of these little side trips. And that's what I'm, well, one of the many things I'm very anxious to see in this series.
I'm sure they'll do episodes where individual characters or groups of characters go off on their own little adventure. You know, there could be a whole string of adventures of Glenn running through Atlanta, finding supplies and encountering remnants of society.
And that's where the story can be updated, where things that were not current in 2003 and 2004 when the early issues were coming out, which are current, can be incorporated into the story.
I wonder, I mean, I like what you said about the FEMA aspect. I didn't think about that when I was reading the comic, but I think that could be a really an interesting, like, political angle they could go to in the story.
Yeah, the comic book has been running for 7 years, and if you think about it, you know, when it premiered in 2003, September 11th, 2001 was just a couple years in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of September 11th. We've got Hurricane Katrina, almost 5 years in the past now. So much has happened that was not, you know, it may have already happened when Robert Kirkman was writing The Walking Dead, but it wasn't really a part of his personal narrative and history the way it probably is now that so much time has passed. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they update the story. And, you know, also, in 2002, 2003, obviously, you know, the web was in existence. People had email. People had cell phones. But it wasn't as ubiquitous as it is now. You know, there was no Facebook back then. Cell phones were still kind of expensive. You know, not everybody had one. It was not so unusual then for somebody to not have a cell phone. So it'll be interesting to see if the changes that have taken place in society since the beginning of The Walking Dead comic strip or comic book series get incorporated into the TV show, or if they just sort of let all that slide and just sort of ignore the differences between 2010 and 2003.
I mean, they could do a period piece and just say it's set in 2003. And
that would be interesting.
But I don't expect that will be the case. I think it'll be set in some random current time.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they'll make it totally current and they'll talk about Obama and they'll talk about other things, but I don't know. I just don't expect them to date themselves like that.
You know, something that I thought about earlier, when we were talking about how people in the story, some of them are expecting rescue.
Right.
And it gradually dawns on everybody at some point or another, except for Shane, that rescue is just not coming. And I think back to The Mist, which was the Stephen King story that was adapted to the screen by Frank Darabont, in which everybody, all the main characters who have fled, and as I understand it, the short story just ends with them fleeing south, and you don't know what happened to them. But in the movie, they run out of gas, they're all sitting in a car on the side of the road, they realize that the car is no real protection for them, and that they're going to die. They're going to die horribly at the hands of these monsters. But they have a pistol, and they have one fewer bullets than they have people. So the main character takes it upon himself to shoot everybody else, including his own son, And then he steps out of the car and into the mist, and he just waits for death. And he even shouts at the monsters, "Come and get me." And just at that moment, a tank comes rumbling through the mist, and the mist starts to clear, and this military convoy is coming through. And minutes after they had all given up to despair and he had killed everybody and, you know, wanted to die, the government came through, rescue materialized, and order was restored, which was just, you know, the ultimate dystopic ending for this one character anyway. You know, the ultimate unhappy ending.
Yes, quite the downbeat ending.
Yeah.
Yeah, I took issue with that ending, but, you know, it was brave, and, my hat's off to Frank Darabont for going there.
And it's his willingness to do something like that, which, you know, it just has me so excited that he is the series driver on this show.
Yeah, the guy, Mick Garris, who has done some of the Stephen King adaptations, you know, he's done a fine job, but he's no Frank Darabont.
And, what did he do?
Well, he did the Shining remake. He did The Stand. You know, he's done good stuff. And I think for a television product, I mean, he's made really commendable stuff, but he's no Frank Darabont. I mean, when you think about the things that Frank Darabont has done, like Shawshank and Green Mile and The Mist. I mean, this is a guy who knows how to make movies.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the interviews and stuff I've seen of him, he is such a geek and such a fan. And just, it's, I feel like he's one of us, and I'm really happy he's the guy who's behind the camera and creating this thing.
Well, Marty, it seems like we are probably getting to the point where, that's about as much as we can expect the pilot of The Walking Dead to cover in terms of the story from the comic book. So there's a big spoiler about what happens when Frank gets to the camp of survivors. That we should probably save. And we'll talk about that in some future episode, probably after we have seen, you know, the premiere of The Walking Dead and seen how closely it sticks to the storyline of the comic and how far they progress in that first episode. But I think episode number 3 of our podcast will be a reaction to the premiere.
Excellent.
Well, Marty, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. The next time we talk about The Walking Dead, it may well be in a face-to-face conversation, and I look forward to that.
I look forward to that, too. You take care and be careful when you're driving here. And yeah, we'll pile up around the TV, and we'll settle in with some popcorn and cheer it on.
Sounds good. And listeners, do join us for that conversation. It should be fun. If you like this one, you'll like that one.
Place. Everybody that comes in gets swallowed up.
Send me the cops.